Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome to another podcast. It's sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, S&R Remodeling, and the Axley Law Firm. Joining us now, associate editor of the Capital Times and correspondent for The Nation, it's John Nichols. John, first of all, before we get any further, how's the book tour going for the Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse?
It's actually been really great. Been, you know, as you know, all over the country, New York, Washington, L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, various sundry other places, and all great crowds, all good energy. Bunch of good reviews, which is really nice.
Now, I have not read it yet. I just received it. The word horsemen, does that exclude you from talking about Betsy DeVos?
No, she's the star of the book.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's sort of a biblical reference.
Okay, good.
Universal.
We won't tell Ann Gaylor.
You know, I'm going to take the hit. No, the argument that I make is a very simple one, and that is that everybody's really worried about Trump and the apocalypse, i.e. that he presses some button, starts a nuclear war, and that's the end of it. And I totally respect that fear. But what I'm suggesting is that if Trump never does that, we still have not averted the Trumpocalypse, which is that he has empowered people to run all the cabinet agencies, all the regulatory bodies, putting people into the courts. He's literally, through his appointments, creating a full government. And most of the people that he has empowered are people who want to, as Steve Bannon once said, deconstruct the administrative state. They want to use the power of government to take away the protections and the services and basically the vision that grew out of the New Deal of a government that was on our side and totally transform things. And if they succeed, Sly, that will be a transformational reality for America. It will make this country dramatically crueler, dramatically more difficult to live in. And so I don't want anybody to miss the reality that's going on. And I think, frankly, most of our media does, because they're so focused on Trump. They don't look at what a Scott Pruitt or a Betsy DeVos or a Jeff Sessions are doing on a daily basis to undermine environmental protections, education, civil rights, civil liberties. And, you know, just to remind you, you know, Rick Perry's in charge of managing our nuclear waste.
Well, what could go wrong there? You know, let me ask you where the, you know, give me a brief answer to where you think the point of mutual agreement is between people that voted for Trump because they were really disappointed that Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Bushes had a certain callousness towards Appalachia with their economic policies and had really overlooked wide swatches of our Swiss cheese economy and kind of felt like, well, they didn't really like Trump all that much, but they thought at least he was paying attention to them. I don't think they voted for a cruel government. I don't think they voted to have their Medicaid or Medicare cut. Where's the connection between your book and that common mutual interest among Americans in spite of who they voted for? You know, you understand my question?
Oh, totally. In fact, I write a lot about that in the book. I think that's the way to understand it. Even people who may like Trump for kind of turning over the apple cart, right, for, you know, really kind of blowing things up, are often incredibly uncomfortable with the conflicting realities of his administration. And this is a big deal. I don't think there are very many people who voted for Donald Trump's Charlottesville speech, right? You know, where he's like moral equivalencies between racists and people that oppose racists. But I also, at a deeper level, I know that people in Appalachia didn't vote for the assaults, you know, for the continuing assault, the continuing efforts to assault the Affordable Care Act, Medicare, Medicaid, which is, you know, central to what this administration is about. And they certainly didn't vote for the hidden reality of what's going on under Tom Price over at the HHS. You know, Congress didn't vote to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And they didn't, Congress did not vote for the assault on Medicaid that was part of that repeal, and that frankly is you know, top agenda item for Paul Ryan. And yet, over at HHS, on a daily basis, Tom Price undermines the ACA, undermines the system.
Well, there's quite an interesting graph of the number of Midwest and Southern states that went for Trump, where the enrollment is down in the ACA because of some of the efforts of the administration.
And this is what I want people to focus on. I want people to understand that unless we look at the whole of the administration, what these people are doing, where they come from, who they are, why they will advance the policies that they want to advance, no matter what Donald Trump says publicly, why they will in fact go after access to health care, why they will in fact, in the case of Price, you know, strengthen the hand at every turn of the insurance companies, of the healthcare industry, of millionaire doctors like himself. Remember, there are many doctors who want to reform and repair our healthcare system, but he's not one of them. They're going to run the risk of thinking that we're winning at points when we're losing. And the other place where I would, you know, really emphasize that folks are not paying enough attention is, you know, you look at what Mick Mulvaney and the budget people are doing. They really are determined to downsize the federal government in dramatic ways, the domestic programs, and move that money to the Pentagon, and then also implement tax cuts. What that will leave us with is gutted out domestic programs, and this is a huge agenda item for these folks. They even go after they even go after Meals on Wheels. Gutted out domestic programs, a dramatically more bloated Pentagon than we have ever had before, and in the mix of all this, a lowering of taxes, cutting of taxes for the wealthy, that will invariably lead to massive deficits that will make government less functional. This is bad stuff.
All right, that merges perfectly into the healthcare debate. And as Senator Sanders introduced his legislation, you had an exclusive interview with him. Well, maybe not exclusive, but you had an interview with him.
I was. Yeah, I sat with him. It was me and him.
Okay. You had an interview with him for The Nation. I suggest people read it. Tell us about that interview.
Well, as he was putting the plan together, I sat down with him. It was a much longer interview. I talked to him about a host of issues. In fact, it's part of a long-term project I'm doing on the Democratic Party and its future. And so I'm interviewing a lot of major players. And that was the primary focus of the interview. But as we started out, we took about, a portion of time, a substantial portion of time as it ended up, talking about Medicare for All, single-payer plan, in the perspective of the moment that we're in. And what I found was fascinating was this. I gave Sanders an opportunity early on to, you know, like, pat himself on the back, claim all sorts of credit. I said, you know, do you think your 2016 campaign has influenced the sort of rise in interest in a single-payer plan? I was interested in what he thought about that. He did not seize that opportunity. It was fascinating. What he did instead was, A, very much kind of return to his movement roots and say, you know, look, single payer has been around for a long time, going back decades. It's always been a viable proposal, but it's never gotten the traction that it needed, right? It's never had the profile, never had the energy. And what he suggested is the reason that it's very hot right now may have a little bit to do with the fact that he spoke about it in every campaign stop in 2016, but that it has a lot more to do with a dual reality, and that is that Republicans are so determined to destroy the Affordable Care Act that they've actually reopened a broader discussion about health care. I mean, people really are talking about it.
Well, there's two things going on right now. Obviously, with Sanders' efforts and some interesting people signing on, i.e. they're running for president.
Yeah. And there's many that are much more moderate.
Right. Yeah. But then we also have Ron Johnson and Mitch McConnell's effort to bring back, much like in a horror movie, in a slasher movie, you know, Freddy comes back. And what should you do whenever you hear the word block grant, John?
Run screaming from the room.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, because you are going to be blocked from getting what you need.
Right.
And this is the interesting point, though. It has opened up this debate on health care, right? And so what Sanders said was, first and foremost, he defended the Affordable Care Act because there are people at risk of losing what they've got. But then you also acknowledge that the reason this issue is in play is because people are not fully satisfied with the Affordable Care Act. It doesn't do everything that they want or they need. And in that moment, if you simply defend the Affordable Care Act, but don't also propose a next stage, something that does address the needs, the Republicans will come in there with their schemes and with their, you know, literally as grifters, you know, like blowing into town looking for a way to, you know, play on people's fears. And that's what Johnson and McConnell are doing. What Sanders has tried to do is to put forward a clear alternative to not just what the Republicans are doing, but to where we're at right now, and to say Affordable Care Act is a good start, and Medicare and Medicaid have to be defended. Those are first-tier fights. But then as part of making that fight, you tell us where you want to go. And so suddenly Medicare for All is a very hot commodity, and it is that combination of the fact that the Republican determination to get rid of Affordable Care Act has made health care a very central issue of the moment, and the second tier part of that, that people do want more than what they've got. I think that's why so many Democrats who in the past would not have co-sponsored have done so with the Sanders bill. You now have to see.
Here is Bernie Sanders on Meet the Press yesterday.
You know, Gallup does a lot of polling on this issue, and what they find out is that the most popular health insurance program in this country is Medicare.
Right.
People, seniors, feel really good. Veterans Administration ranks very high. In fact, private insurance company is not all that popular. Well, we have to tell the average worker the only thing that is changing in this program, this is not quote-unquote a government takeover. The only thing that's changing is the color of your insurance card, from a Blue Cross Blue Shield card, a United Health card, okay, to a Medicare for All card. You're still going to go to the doctor you want. It's the same structure.
I'm the Democrat.
I'm not sure that entirely sunk in with Chuck Todd. No. Because he kept going down the garden variety questions that are always raised about the cost. Well, the cost of our healthcare system, they act like that money isn't being taken out of people's paychecks right now, but it is.
No, it's just, look, it literally is. If you've ever been in New York where there's like, you remember the old days where they had the guys with the car or with the little shells they'd move around, you could pick one of them and see if you...
I haven't spent a lot of time in there. I've been to New York twice, and I have to tell you, it wasn't my favorite place.
I'm digging it. Okay. Think of any street scam you've ever seen, right? That's what the people who want to stop single payer are all about. They want to fool you and make you bet on something else. Oh, yeah, there can be a market solution. Not going to be a market solution. Oh, yeah, there can be a public-private solution. There's not going to be a public-private solution. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we will end up with single payer. It's where you have to go. It's just a matter of how painful it is to get there.
Senator Sanders' proposal, in some respects, is more generous than the Canadian healthcare system, as it includes eye and dental and some other things that the Canadian system doesn't. Is it in Canada? It really is a provincial. There is an over there. There's a guaranteed right overarching throughout the country, and the federal government funds it, but the provinces administer it. Would Senator Sanders' system be similar?
Potentially, because we have so much federalism in the U.S., and the states do, as you know, with Medicare and Medicaid, have a huge role in a lot of this stuff. So it's possible there. But the thing to understand, you know, like the British system, for instance, is a national health care, a classic national health care Canadian system, because it came up provincially, right? It didn't start as a national plan. It came one province and then another. It has a different structure. Be careful not to get lost in the weeds on this. As America moves toward a single-payer plan, and we will, it's not going to, you know, everything won't be set on the day you start discussing it. There will be push and pull. There will be challenges. It may be possible that some states come first and do, in fact, implement before you get the national.
It'll be good to see Mississippi leading the charge.
You know what? They need it.
But here's
the bottom line, though. This is the important one. Some people are all excited about calling it Medicare for All. They say, oh, single payer, that's, people won't understand that. That's too complicated. I disagree. I think single payer is a really good name, because the bottom line to understand this is that at the end of the day, there's a single payer. It is the government. Through our taxes, we put our tax money in, and the government does it. What that means is you get rid of all the insurance bureaucracy. You get rid of all the grifters and all the profiteers, and you end up with a system that is actually about people going to get the health care they need without all the deductibles, without all the, you know, all the money you pay before you ever get anywhere near the health care you need. And just, you know, you go to the doctor, you got a problem, doctor takes care of it, the doctor submits the bill, it's paid. And trust me, this is a system that people will love. They will, you know, of course if people gripe about some aspect of it or another, but at the end of the day, they would never, ever trade it away to go back to the old system. That will never, ever happen.
And that's
never,
what
happens anywhere.
And that's what scares the hell out of Rush Limbaugh. We'll take a break. It is John Nichols, Capital Times, and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
St. Vincent de Paul helps with vouchers for people whose homes or apartments have been destroyed by fire or flood, families that have gone through domestic abuse, families that have had to move, kids who outgrow clothes. St. Vincent de Paul stores are also a great way for you to help. Shop the St. Vincent de Paul stores throughout Dane County.
You're listening to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and other great unions like Madison Firefighters, Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and Madison Teamsters, Local 695. John Nichols from the Capital Times. We're talking a little bit about Senator Sanders. I thought this was an interesting exchange yesterday. Chuck Todd asked Senator Sanders what label he will run in for re-election in Vermont.
Party, you're in some ways the most influential member of it, yet you're not technically a member of it. The filing deadline to file as a Democrat for the United States Senate in Vermont in 2018 is about 3 months earlier than it is for you to file as an independent. It's in May. Do you plan to file as a Democrat or as an independent when you run for re-election in 2018?
Well, I will do what I have done in the past. Let me just say something about this. The current model of the Democratic Party obviously is not working. Republicans control the House, the Senate, they control the White House, they control two-thirds of the governor's offices throughout this country. In my view, Chuck, what we need to do is to reach out to independents. There are a heck of a lot more independents in this country than there are Republicans or Democrats. I am an independent, have always been a Democrat, have worked within the Democratic caucus in the House and the Senate for over 25 years. I'll continue to do that.
So you'll become a member of the Democratic Party when you think it's finally open enough for independents?
It's not a question. Actually, in Vermont, there's not a question of a litmus test. I think that the Democratic Party has got to reach out to working people. It's got to reach out to young people. has got to come up with a progressive agenda. And by the way, that agenda is gaining momentum, $15 an hour minimum wage.
Okay.
Putting $1 trillion into rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, transforming our energy system. That's the agenda we've got to fight on.
All right.
Okay. Your response to that?
Well, you know, the answer came in the first, you know, like 2 seconds.
Right, it did.
So I'll do what I've always done.
Right.
And
which is more committal. He had been a little less committal to... I think it was up in the air maybe last year. I heard him give an answer that was a little less committal than that.
Yeah, I've asked him about it many times over the years, and I've always been a little unsatisfied. I've often been a little unsatisfied with the answer. Because often what Sanders has done is say, well, we'll get to that when the time is right. You know what I mean? Or something like And now because it is actually, you know, we're getting toward the time when these decisions have to be made. Sanders is remaining where he's always been, which is as an independent. He's an independent in caucuses with the Democrats. And I think for, you know, I know people outside Wisconsin listen to this podcast, but you and I are Wisconsinites. And one of the things to understand is that, you know, the great Wisconsin progressive Robert M. La Follette started as a Republican, ran for president as an independent progressive. His kids formed a senator and a governor. Both La Follette formed the Progressive Party. When the Progressive Party had representatives in Congress, they served as progressives, but they were often closely aligned with the Democratic caucus. And Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, regularly celebrated them, thanked them for, you know, the contribution they made. The reason Roosevelt was successful was because he was more than willing to include progressives, nonpartisan league members, farmer laborites from Minnesota, American Labor Party members from New York, liberal Republicans, and independents in that big, big New Deal coalition. I think what Sanders advocates for is this notion that ought to be the vision that the Democratic Party ought to embrace. He is going to get tremendous resistance to that. He already does. There are an awful lot of people who, frankly, cannot and will not forgive him for not being a Democrat, for not registering and paying the dues and doing the party line. In Vermont, when he runs for re-election, there's an interesting dynamic of Vermont. Every state has different election laws. And one of the weird things that can happen in Vermont is if enough people write you in for the Democratic nomination or the Republican nomination, you win the nomination, and then you can turn it down, and then the ballot line is left empty. That has happened in the past, and my suspicion is that it may, for Sanders, happen again, although there will be some Democrats who are still mad at him about the 2016 campaign or whatever else, will try to have a Democratic candidate.
Let me ask you about kind of what's going on in our society in a broader sense. A couple of things struck me, you know, as we record this podcast this morning, Donald Trump retweeted a ridiculous video of him swinging a golf club and it knocking Hillary down. Mm-hmm. They actually mm-hmm. used footage of the secretary falling down in an airplane. Kellyanne Conway was on Fox and Friends after the Emmys and made
her back, by the way.
What's that?
Good to see her back.
Yeah, well, it is good to see her back. And she made this comment.
2 months and all for what? I guess it's sort of the same. It's the sameness. It's they got plucked and polished and waxed, and some of them didn't eat for 2 months and all for what? To sound the same. And they have a right to speak. But if you're tuning in to watch.
You know, she's paid for her salary is paid by the taxpayers of the United right. States. She right. She represents America. Do you ever think you'd see an administration where you have a spokesperson for the president attacking people's physicality? I mean, look, I pose for no holy pictures on this. I'm provocateur over the years. But yeah, I do understand the difference between, you know, if I was ever speaking next to Russ Feingold or on behalf of Russ Feingold, which I was never paid to do, but if I was anywhere within his space, believe me, I had a different decorum than if I was, you know, on my radio show.
Well, again, you go to the heart of the matter. Kellyanne Conway's in my book. All right, I've got a big chapter on her. I think she's actually much more central to the Trump administration than people recognize, and certainly to the whole Trump experiment. And what's important to understand is she accepted this role within government, and yet it's clear, and this is not just a Trump phenomenon. It's a phenomenon that's gone back in recent decades. It's clear that her primary role is to be political, to divide people, to attack people. I mean, she's at the you know, in the official capacity that she's in, she is at odds with and often at war with folks, including the press. And that does relate to what the president did. The president's obsession with Hillary Clinton, his, you know, visceral hatred, is a deeply troubling thing, because, you know, we have had people who've gotten elected to the presidency in the past who have disliked their opponent, who haven't wrapped their arms around it immediately. But, you know, when all is said and done, they went forward. I mean, there's simply no question that Barack Obama, when he became president of the United States, he didn't obsess with attacking Mitt Romney or you know, John McCain. And George W. Bush, to his credit, having, you know, gotten to the presidency in a very conflicted election, certainly didn't go after Al Gore on a regular basis. So what Trump's doing is different. He is himself, and in his administration, he's using his administration to maintain this campaign footing. And it's very crude. It's very destructive. And frankly, it is one of the reasons why you have to examine the whole of this administration much more closely, because what you find is that Trump tweet from yesterday is reflected by so many of his appointees. They keep going back to Clinton,
right,
and hating him.
Well, it is perplexing. Over the weekend, in response to what happened in St. Louis with the officer being acquitted and the demonstrations and some violence, the Wisconsin Law Enforcement Memorial was vandalized. I helped raise money for that in 1997, the first time I was at WIBA-FM. And it was spray painted, and the remarks were made about what happened in St. Louis. And, of course, it becomes a political football. The college Republicans on the UW campus, obviously very active in condemning it. But I thought this response was interesting from Claudia Kochel, press secretary for the University College Democrats. She told the Daily Cardinal that the current system has failed many communities of color, and it is not the party's role to condemn people that have been oppressed and their response to oppression. I'd like your reaction to that.
Well, we're going through college Democrats at college.
Right. No, but I do think it signifies what's kind of going on right now.
Well, look, here's the bottom line on this. We have a great deal of conflict as regards policing. One thing that we should absolutely recognize: it is wrong to disrespect police officers who've been killed on the job. It is wrong to disrespect people who have been killed in incidents with the police. You know what I mean? Who may have been killed wrongly, or where there are investigations and inquiries. What we have to recognize is this: when somebody dies, what we want to do is get to the bottom of it, and we want to get justice. If a police officer is killed on the job, overwhelmingly that police officer was trying to save somebody's life or trying to prevent something horrible from happening, and we should respect that. rather, you know,
well, even if they haven't broken the law, in some cases, yeah, used extremely poor judgment.
If right. they've engaged, if right. they've engaged someone that doesn't get us to justice,
right.
they should be held to account. But this notion, and I've seen it on, this is the thing that troubles me. I've seen people go after the victims of violence.
It happened after Charlottesville.
Right.
Think of the calls that mother received. I'm just I'm not trying to make a political statement. Obviously, I feel passionately about that memorial because I helped raise money for it. I talked about 9/11 and paying homage to the workers that died that day and the people that died that day. And, you know, I had all these political responses on my Facebook about the Iraq War and this and that. And I said, can we not just take this day and this moment to reflect on the lives lost in this incident? And these were workers. These were people. I don't understand why have people lost that sense of proportionality, decency? What is wrong?
Because people too often, and I blame our media for this. I don't blame individuals for this. I blame our media for this. We have dumbed down and simplified things to such a level that, you know, people, you know, they fall into this trap of thinking that it's got to be either or. There are a lot of complicated issues. I spoke just after 9/11 to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and one of the things that I think hardly anybody knows, that, you know, among the first responders who went into that building or went into those buildings on 9/11, there were police officers. There were firefighters, no question of that. There were also, guess who gets called in situations like that?
You bet.
Electricians.
Well, guess who gets called in hurricanes?
Yeah.
Right.
And so one of the things I was trying to, and we were talking, I was just talking about it, the context of it, people need to understand that when someone's in a terrible, a difficult situation, and they die in that situation, their family has suffered a terrible loss. Society has suffered a loss. And so, you know, to focus our anger on a memorial for police officers, or frankly, to focus our anger on the family of Heather Heyer,
it is absolutely atrocious. Here's a little fact as we wrap up today. You know, I think there are 65,000 people being monitored for the potential of getting cancer, or people that have cancer that were part of the cleanup of Ground Zero and at the Pentagon. Between 10 and 15 cases each week, there are new, unfortunately, diagnoses of cancer. So people are still dying from 9/11 that went and worked, cleaned up, tried to recover people. So this is an ongoing thing, and I just think people should be respected for that.
Well, and also just think, the bottom line is, I'm going to bet you know of no one who is more opposed to the Iraq War than I. In fact, in the aftermath of 9/11, I wrote one of the first articles about opposing a military response to what happened on 9/11, or at least arguing that the response to it might involve the military, but it should be targeted toward those who did it, not just invading some country or you know, going in the ways that we ended up going. And so I'm passionate in my opposition to the politicization of what happened on 9/11. I despise what George Bush and Dick Cheney and others did. By the same token, I don't think that I have to be angry at, you know, or somehow like dismiss what happened that day. You know, what happened that day was a terrible trauma. It was an awful tragedy, and we should have passionate response on behalf of those who died and those who are alive but are sick. And, you know, we can put all these thoughts in our head at the same time.
Yeah, that is the best way to put it. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation and the author of The Horseman of the Trumpocalypse. Thanks for coming on with us, John.